And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
On today's show, salt marshes along the East Coast are suddenly dying, and scientists really don't know what's happening. And a newly released report says our national parks are being impacted by pollution, and it's time for America to make some decisions. And kids these days have some great choices when it comes to learning about some of the Earth's living creatures. It's all coming up right now, here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
With the hurricane season half over, and as we prepare to mark the first anniversary of the legendary Hurricane Katrina, Little Debbie, our newest hurricane, is spinning up some momentum way out in the Atlantic. But forecasters say Little Debbie will likely go on her own merry way without touching the Atlantic coast. Which gets some people saying, see, this global warming thing is a hoax. But then you hear from the director of the U.S. National Hurricane Center, Max Mayfield, who says, the worst is yet to come. It could be this year, it could be 5 years from now, but keep building as we are along the coast, and it is just a matter of time. So don't let Little Debbie fool you. Rather, stay tuned in. Today, we're going to tune you onto a story that can use a little help from people like you, because to this point, it has the scientists baffled. Salt marshes along the East and Gulf Coast are developing a sudden death syndrome of sorts that causes scattered areas along the coastal marshes to just suddenly lose all their plant life. We'll be heading east to Cape Cod to stir up a little muck. Then, it seems air pollution is making news again as researchers are coming to understand the long-term effects of bad air, which seems to be an ongoing problem, particularly in our national parks, where its effects can be seen, literally, and clouding the future of our natural treasury. The National Parks Conservation Association calls this a turning point, and we talk with one of the authors of this report in our second segment. Then in segment three, it's the kids who will face the world of tomorrow, and there are exciting new learning tools that make it easier for nature-conscious parents to share their values with their kids. We talk with publisher and author Cheryl Block about her book and CD explorations into the worlds of science. It's all coming up, but first, the news. A federal judge on Tuesday ruled that the Bush administration's plans to apply their management plans to log within the Grand Sequoia National Monument are in violation of existing environmental laws. In the lawsuit filed last year by the Sierra Club, the Forest Service was singled out as crafting their own science to justify cutting timber in this reserve that contains two-thirds of all sequoia trees as a concession to timber interests which were active in crafting the regulations in the first place. The Forest Service justified the thinning, translated as logging, within the reserve in order to decrease the prospect of forest fires. Bruce Hamilton, conservation director for the Sierra Club, stated that today's ruling only strengthens the case for transferring management of this magnificent monument to neighboring Sequoia National Park, where it would be treated with the good stewardship that it deserves. These sentiments were heard echoing through the Grand Sequoias following the court's decision. Many Americans are admitting that it is getting more and more difficult to keep track of just where the war to drill for oil and natural gas in Alaska stands, but it is getting clearer each day that the Bush administration really doesn't care as long as they can finish the job and drill for that oil. That is why they reaffirmed that they will be putting up 696 new tracks for oil and gas exploration in the northeast and northwest areas of the National Petroleum Reserve, with sales to be conducted September 27th of this year. Despite the ongoing concerns by many people, Native Americans, little old ladies, children, and even a few evangelicals who care about God's creation. 8 million acres will be opened up, including that hard-to-pronounce area known as Teshikpuk Lake, a critical calving area to hundreds of thousands of caribou and millions of other living things. The announcement made just weeks after the oil pipeline was shut down due to the potential for increasing leaks due to corrosion in the hundreds of miles of pipes and following over 600 spills in the last year actually comes as no surprise to almost anyone who has followed this battle over the past 20-plus years. There's something about Teshikpuk Lake that just seems to keep the oil companies fixated on being able to poke holes in the permafrost and see what's below. With just over a month before the gavels fall on the oil deals, meanwhile, caribou have started their annual migration to the Teshikpuk Lake region to stage a calf-in, as they do each year. And meanwhile, in the ancient city which gave its name to the Holy Bible, the city of Byblos in Lebanon, the holy wars between Israeli leaders and Muslim Hezbollah has turned this ancient seaport, renowned for its white sand beaches, into a hell of a mess, as black, tarry, sticky oil now smothers the beaches in Byblos and seaside towns all along Lebanon, and soon in Cyprus and other Mediterranean seaport towns, cities, and villages. The oil slick, which is the result of the Israeli attacks on a power plant last month, has sludged an 87-mile stretch of historic coastline. Lebanese officials have begun cleanup work and have already dredged up over 100 tons of oil from the waters. It is the worst such disaster in Lebanese history. Reports are that someone somewhere believes that this disaster is justified. However, as not only the news but the ooze spreads throughout the Mediterranean, even this lone spokesman seems to have slithered off into hiding. And all that's left now is the cleanup. Send your soap and rags to your favorite relief agency. And a month ago it was reported that the Greenland ice cap is melting twice as fast as had been expected. Well, based on new evidence from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, this estimate must be revised. The corrected report should read, "The Greenland ice cap is melting at 3 times the speed expected." And that's the news. So now we head east, where there's a mystery in the marshes that has scientists squirming for answers. Now we're heading off to the east coast to do a story about a sudden occurrence that is confusing scientists and researchers, that involves the very critical salt marshes that line the coastal areas literally all around the world. And to help us talk about this problem, we're talking now with Steve Smith, who is with the Cape Cod National Seashore. Stephen, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
There's a story that's being circulated now that's becoming current. This has to do with the observation that it seems as if there tends to be a new trending towards a sudden death of certain marshes on the East Coast. Why don't you give me the scientist's perspective on that?
In years since 2002, we've been discovering that certain portions of salt marshes here on Cape Cod and elsewhere in New England, but mostly on Cape Cod, have exhibited this pattern of vegetation dieback that seems to be rather sudden in most cases, whereby, you know, an area of marshes, you know, full of healthy vegetation 1 year, and then the next year a portion of it is gone, and all that remains is sort of the dead roots and shoots, or like a stubble appearance. There's sites all over New England, but the majority of it seems to be, or the worst of it seems to be happening on Cape Cod. Now that said, it's still a very small proportion of, you know, all our marsh area. I said the worst of it is on Cape Cod in Wellfleet Bay, and we're only seeing dieback in about maybe 5 to 10% of the marsh, but it's enough to make us both interested and a little concerned about what's going on, because it doesn't seem that this is this follows any precedent. In other words, people that have been working in salt marshes for their entire careers haven't really seen this happen before. And it's the salt marsh vegetation really makes up the structure of the salt marsh, and it's the vegetation that that dampens wave energy and protects our coastlines from erosion. It's the vegetation that provides the base of the food chain and supports a whole variety of life. It's one of the most productive ecosystems in the world, actually, and it exports a lot of organic matter out to coastal waters, which fuels, you know, all that life out there, too. So it's the actual, the grasses that make up the structural habitat for a variety of critters, including fishes and birds and things like that that nest in it. So it's really the vegetation that is the salt marsh, and when you lose the vegetation and it gets converted to mudflats, you have a whole different type of ecosystem. And we're seeing in parts of the marsh that have shown this die-off a significant erosion of sediments. There's no roots to bind the sediments anymore, and so the sediments are being washed out with the tides, and it results in a huge change in the ground surface topography.
I know there's been a bit of research to try to determine what this is, and it's a little baffling, but there are some serious theories about what is causing this dieback. Why don't you discuss some of those?
Well, it is really baffling, and the reason it's really baffling is because the spatial patterns of dieback don't seem to correlate in any obvious way with the kinds of environmental factors that you would typically associate with declining plant vigor. For example, if we suspected that dieback was a result of sea level rise and the kind of stress that sea level rise would bring to a plant is that they would be inundated for longer periods of time, submerged underwater, and that flooding stress may cause dieback. If that were the case, we'd expect to see dieback occurring at the lowest elevation to the marsh, all along the lower marsh edges, but we see it all over the place, over a very wide range of elevations. It doesn't seem to correlate with salinity levels in any way, or position in the marsh. We're seeing at least two different species of salt marsh plant die back. It seems to occur over a wide range of soil types. It occurs in marshes that are pretty distant from any development or any human-related impacts, as well as marshes that are adjacent to fairly developed uplands. So that's a confusing thing about it.
So if you find a marsh, let's say, that begins to die back, do you then see it sort of spreading to nearby marshes, which would indicate perhaps some sort of
disease? We don't know yet. We've really only begun to figure out the extent of dieback and get some on-the-ground monitoring going to track changes in the extent of dieback, whether it's getting worse or staying the same or whether we're seeing recovery. We only have a few data points in that regard. Mm-hmm. Just started doing that in 2004, essentially. It's obvious, anecdotally, that in some places it's definitely getting worse. In some places it looks to sort of be staying the same. The dieback area is much like it was a few years ago. I haven't seen any recovery yet, but in other areas of the country where dieback has been observed as well, such as in Georgia, they saw a lot of recovery. So there's still that hope for us. We just don't have enough data yet to really say one way or another what the trajectory of things is. Mm-hmm. Right now.
Well, there's sort of two main streams of possibilities. One may be that there is some sort of physical change, that it could be chemical, or some people are even discussing the fact that ice may be breaking up and cutting off or killing plants or different things. And the other would be some sort of systemic, that is to say, perhaps a fungus or some sort of disease that's being spread.
Right.
Any trends on either one of those in terms of the theories?
Well, we don't think it's ice because we're seeing dieback in places where we don't get much ice. And ice generally tends to just sort of shear off the dead foliage and mm-hmm. leave the roots and rhizomes alone, which can just resprout in the spring. Probably the best evidence that it's not ice or geese or large rack accumulations in the marsh is that we're seeing dieback happen this summer in one marsh right in front of our eyes. A few weeks ago, mid-July, there are big swaths of plants dying, which is, these plants don't usually brown up until the end of October. So we're sort of seeing it happen for the first time right in front of our eyes. Most of these dieback areas that we've come across, the event has already happened, and we're sort of doing forensic science, so to speak. After the fact, there are a few things we can cross off the list in terms of you know, physical things like ice rafting and or biotic variables such as geese. But there's also the possibility that it is some sort of either existing or new pathogen. We've sent plant samples to a couple of pathologists, Ray Schneider at LSU and Wade Elmer at Connecticut Agricultural Research Station. They've isolated various strains of fungus from these plants, which is not abnormal. You know, typically these plants do live with a variety of fungi on them, but they're now in the midst of doing pathogenicity tests to basically figure out whether certain strains can by themselves cause mortality. But I think the feeling is right now that that the plants are under some sort of physiological stress that we don't yet understand the cause of, and things like fungus or other biotic variables such as aphids or plant hoppers or even herbivorous crabs sort of jump on the bandwagon, so to speak, and can accelerate, take advantage of these susceptible plants that are in a weakened state and can thereby accelerate the decline.
Mm-hmm. And some people are suggesting that there's changes in the soil increasing the level of sulfuric acid that naturally weaken.
Some dieback in other parts of the country has been attributed to drought conditions where you get major changes in soil chemistry as a result. But in our case, it doesn't really work because we have a huge tide in Cape Cod Bay. It averages about 10 feet.
Mm.
Ranges from about 9 to 12 feet, and a lot of our dieback sites are inundated twice daily by tide. So when you get soils flooded with alkaline seawater, you can't have the kind of soil chemistry changes that we've seen in other parts of the country, decreased pH or increased acidity and mobilization of metals and so forth.
That would totally override the micro changes in the soils.
Right.
I know that, you know, scientists are beginning to talk and begin to share the fact that this is noticeable along the eastern coastline. What is the extent? Is it up in Canada, for example? Are people noticing it there? Is it down in Florida? What is it sort of isolated? Give me a sense of that.
Well, there's been pretty extensive dieback in Louisiana in the 1990s and subsequent recovery, actually, of a lot of it. Then in sort of 2001, 2002, there was huge dieback in Georgia, you know, much larger than what we're seeing here in New England. And I'm not sure what the status of those areas right now. I know some areas have recovered. I think some areas are still mud flat. In New England, it's scattered pieces of marsh here and there, anywhere from sort of marshes in Connecticut along Long Island, in Long Island Sound, to I think there's a couple sites in Maine, but as I said, the majority of it, the worst of it seems to be on Cape Cod, and even in our marshes, it's only about 5 to 10% of the whole marsh area. But as I said before, it's enough to get us interested and concerned about it and try to figure out what's going on.
Well, this is the kind of thing that the public could help out with in terms of informing people like yourself if they're noticing dieback in their local marshes along the coastal areas. You're looking for data right now.
Yeah, well, we are trying to put together a sort of a fact sheet on dieback and how to characterize it, because there is natural dieback that occurs in marshes. Things like we just discussed, rack accumulations, which is sort of the dead plant litter that can accumulate, be deposited in a portion of the marsh and basically smother an area and cause vegetation dieback temporarily. Usually those areas quickly recover. Or there's, you know, there are areas where geese do a lot of damage, again, temporarily. Usually the marsh recovers quickly. Or, you know, there's human impacts to hydrology or even just simple trampling. It's important that we get, if people are going to report this, they know how to characterize it and, you know, aren't giving us information that relates to either natural or human, you know, known human causes of dieback.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in the midst of developing a questionnaire survey form for people to use for that purpose.
What would people be looking for to help understand better what's happening as opposed to a natural? Is there a way to, without getting analytical about it, to kind of recognize that this may be an example of dieback?
You'd have to make observations in a marsh at specific points repeatedly over time. And, you know, if somebody with a house or cottage on a marsh area, overlooking a marsh, if they noticed, for example, that, you know, 1 year a lot of the vegetation was, it had just sort of disappeared from a certain area, and there was no evidence of large rack accumulations or, you know, intense geese gate grazing pressure or anything unusual like that, then I would probably think that I might think that that would be, you know, part of the whole dieback phenomenon that we're seeing here.
I guess one of the strange things is the fact that it just so suddenly appears. That just seems odd. It would indicate perhaps some sort of disease that suddenly appears. And, of course, because you have such interchange between marsh areas by birds specifically, migrating birds, there could be an exchange from one very localized marsh to another spot hundreds of miles away, even, and therefore suddenly would appear there because something has been spread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's possible. I mean, the pathologists that are working on this problem are trying to get those answers.
Mm-hmm.
But and the random nature, the random spatial pattern of dieback, does seem to, you know, lead one to think that it is a pathogen. But and you know, huge entire ecosystems have been taken out by disease. You know, I'm thinking along the lines of, you know, agricultural crops or forests, such as the hemlock being taken out by the woolly adelgid. So, mm-hmm. you know, these things can have pretty widespread, huge consequences. But we just don't know what it is at this point. It may be a pathogen. It may not. We're just not at the point where we can say one way or the other. The thing that's so complex about the situation is that you have, you know, a variety of different physical and chemical and hydrologic parameters to deal with in terms of plant physiological stress. And on top of that, you have biological factors, fungi and crabs and aphids and plant hoppers. And then another confounding layer is that, you know, you do have genetic variability within a marsh, so, you know, some clones of the same species may be more or less susceptible to all these stresses and or diseases than others. So to try to untangle that big web of interactions is difficult at best.
Well, as a scientist myself, it's intriguing in the sense that, based on what you've talked about before, it seems as if this was not something that was observed amongst plant ecologists in the past on any sort of for any extended period of time, and it seems to be suddenly appearing. Now, I'm not trying to suggest, therefore, that there's some that we're causing this, but it may just be a natural phenomenon, a part of the process.
Yeah, I mean, I said that, you know, people that are working their whole careers in salt marshes haven't seen it before, but you know, that's, what, 30, 40 years?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and some of these marshes have been around for thousands of years. So whether this occurred sometime in the past and then subsequent recovery occurred after that, we have no idea. Unfortunately, we also can't use aerial photography right now to try to reconstruct the history of dieback, when it started and the rate at which it's occurring, because we just don't have the resolution to see it. And a lot of the photography that we have access to was taken in winter, spring, or fall, and you don't get a good contrast between growing season vegetation in the summer versus, you know, the mud flats that are being created by the dieback. So that's not been a good tool for us, unfortunately.
So Google Earth isn't going to resolve the issue for you.
No, yeah, not quite.
Which I love. Well, it's an interesting story. Where are you going to go from here? What's the research line?
We're just trying to, you know, by doing on-the-ground monitoring and some very limited experimentation in greenhouses and doing transplanting healthy plants into dieback areas and trying to grow healthy plants in dieback soil and these kinds of things. We're trying to narrow our focus in terms of what direction the research should take, and hopefully by, you know, making people aware of what's happening, not to alarm them, but just to get, you know, make them aware of what's happening, and that'll reach the ears of people that are able to fund more research into this problem. So right now we're trying to organize or synthesize all the existing information we have and hopefully get some money to do a lot more work on it.
Well, very interesting. We're talking with Stephen Smith, who's with the Cape Cod National Seashore. Stephen, if people want to contact you, or who would you recommend that they contact, and perhaps an email or a website or something where they can find out more information?
They can go to a website, which is part of the Northeast Estuarine Research Federation. It's NEERS.org.
Yeah, I have a website here, www.wetlands.neers.org.
Yeah, the NEERS website, yeah, that's it.
Which is really focused on this in a very nice way. Well, Stephen Smith, I'll tell you what, we'll follow this story in the years ahead here and see what happens. Science is interesting, and it'll be interesting to see how this develops.
Okay.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
A real mystery. Well, take a deep breath. Well, actually, maybe that's not such a good idea. Just breathe naturally, and your voice of the earth will return following this short break.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you been to a national park this summer? Well, if you missed the chance, the good news is that most national parks are open year-round, so there'll be plenty of time to enjoy the grand vistas, breathe that nice clean air, and what? This just in. Despite the nature of our national parks, they are experiencing the effects of polluted air just like everyone else. And in some cases, well, you'll just have to stay tuned to learn more. You will, when the voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's so many issues facing our public lands these days, and there's a report that's come out by the National Parks Conservation Association that is saying that the national parks are at a turning point, and we're going to talk about what that means with our guest right now, Mark Wensler. He is with the National Parks Conservation Association, npca.org. He's joining us now from Washington, D.C. Mark, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. It's great to be here.
Well, now, turning point. Give us a sense of what the nature of this turning point report is all about.
You know, it's been about 30 years since Congress passed landmark amendments to the Clean Air Act meant to rid the parks of just really tragic air pollution that was inflicting them, you know, throughout the 60s and early 70s. And, you know, by 1977, the situation was so bad that Congress had to act to adopt special protections in the Clean Air Act for the parks. So it's been nearly 30 years since Congress passed that law. And, you know, it's been a tough road. We've taken a long time to get to where we are now, where we're just finally starting to make improvements in park air quality. You know, the Park Service put out an analysis earlier this year that shows about two-thirds of the parks are either holding steady or making slight improvements. There's some troubling exceptions to that. The Rocky Mountains are getting worse. Yellowstone is getting worse. But, you know, the trend, I think it's fair to say, generally has just turned the corner and started to improve slightly. And just as that's happening, we have the situation where, you know, of course, the country has growing energy demands, and that's understandable. We're trying to get away from importing so much energy from unstable regions of the world, like the Middle East. So we're looking to domestic resources like coal and oil and natural gas. And unfortunately, those are the kinds of energy sources that have the greatest impact on the national parks. So we're at a turning point now because we have the opportunity to make the decision to not develop those resources or develop them more cleanly, to do so in a way that we can have more energy and clean air. We don't have to sacrifice our parks to meet our growing energy demands.
One of the aspects of the report sort of visualizes the development of different energy resources out into the future. It graphically portrays the fact that into the future here, coal is going to become the new energy resource. But let's talk about coal and its relationship to now our concern into the future for the national parks.
The problem is that coal is probably the most polluting thing you can burn to produce electricity. And the power plants that burn it are really not all that different from the design that Thomas Edison came up with over 100 years ago for the first coal-fired power plant, basically setting fire to a huge pile of coal and using the steam to generate turbines that make the electricity. There are a lot more advanced technologies out there that we could be using to burn coal more cleanly, and unfortunately, they're not being required. The states and the federal government are not making the power plant developers use these cleanest technologies. And on top of that, there are alternatives to coal that we could turn to. There's renewable energy sources like wind and solar and geothermal. We recognize that those will never be the majority of the electrical grid system out there, but they are an important source that we can't ignore. We need to develop and we need to invest in those clean energy sources to the extent that we also invest in fossil fuels.
Let's talk about the health effects. You really analyze four different pollutants in detail. Talk about those factors and why they're important, why you singled them out.
The health effects are very disturbing. In fact, we found in a report that more than a third of the 390 national park units out there are located in areas that fail to meet federal minimum healthy air standards. People go to the parks in many instances to seek out healthy outdoor recreation opportunities. And what the science tells us and what the medical profession tells us is that when you exercise, you're breathing in more air and hence more pollution. So that's probably the worst combination if you go to a park to exercise and do so in polluted air. And it's especially dangerous for children who breathe in more air per lung volume than adults do. And for elderly people and also for people with existing respiratory problems like asthma. And the pollutants of greatest concern are sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. And the sulfur dioxide, also called SO2, is responsible for producing very microscopic particles that are able to bypass your lungs' natural defense systems and actually enter your bloodstream directly. And there have been many studies that link that pollutant to very serious lung and heart problems, as well as premature death. In fact, there was a Harvard study a few years back that found that upwards of 30,000 people a year die prematurely from the effects of this fine particle pollution. The second pollutant of concern is nitrogen oxides, also known as NOx, which contributes to a pollutant I think most people are familiar with especially in California, but many other places in the country, ground-level ozone. That's the pollutant that causes code red days in many urban areas around the country, and increasingly in many national parks. Ozone is a powerful respiratory irritant that is linked with asthma attacks and other breathing problems. And it's probably one of the most pervasive air pollution problems that we have in this country right now.
You analyze a variety of different aspects in Turning Point: habitat, health, heritage, horizons, and ultimately you lead to some solutions. Let's talk about habitat. Are we finding that there are changes to national park habitats that are of concern as a result of air quality changes?
Yes, definitely. In fact, you know, it's interesting. Before I got into this line of work, you know, I'm a lifelong backpacker and hiker, and I would, you know, come across yellowing trees and plants on the trail and just thought, oh, that's, you know, an insect problem or a drought or something. But actually, in many cases, that's ozone damage. Ozone is capable of penetrating at the cellular level many leaves from any tree and plant species and actually destroying those cells. And in many cases, it is eliminating certain plants from the parks and sickening others to the point where they're threatened. So it's very direct impacts that you can see if you know what you're looking for. And, you know, besides ozone, there's also mercury is a growing concern. Mercury is a trace metal found in coal. And increasingly, we're finding that near large coal-fired power plants, we're finding large amounts of mercury. A good example that we point to in the report is Mammoth Cave National Park in Kentucky, which is as close as you come to ground zero for coal-fired power plants in the vicinity. And they're finding mercury levels in many of the animals that live in that park that are up to four times higher than the level that's considered safe by EPA when it comes to humans. So extraordinary amount of mercury is turning up in these animals. And mercury is a very, very toxic metal and very dangerous to animals and people alike. It causes reproductive problems. And in humans, it can cause birth defects and developmental delays. And there's actually a link there because many people depend on their diets on fish that are caught, you know, not only in national parks but elsewhere. And I think there's something like 25 states have issued mercury warnings to pregnant women not to consume more than one fish meal a month from fish caught in the waters in their state. So that's, you know, a very serious problem. And, you know, we think that that's something that needs to be addressed right away. I mean, this is something that we really can't wait another 30 years to do something about. These are impacts that are happening now.
You know, 30 years ago, people were talking about the problems of air pollution and trying to address that. As well, they were talking about the problems of energy independence and the fact that there were limits. And unfortunately, we don't seem to listen. That's part of the problem. So hopefully, we're learning to listen. If nothing else, what we need to do is to start to learn to listen when these types of warnings and reports come out. I'd like to also talk about heritage. There are actually some dramatic instances where air pollution have had dramatic impact, literally, on our heritage sites.
You know, most of our national parks are actually created to protect and promote our heritage. They tell the story of who we are as a people, from the early Spanish settlements along the Atlantic and Gulf Coast to the sites of the Civil War and the Revolutionary War, up through more modern-day memorials. And that is probably one of the most defining, important missions of the National Park Service and the National Park System, is to protect our heritage. But air pollution is actually physically damaging that heritage in a lot of different ways. I think some of which, you know, may seem more intuitive than others. The one that most people might have heard of is acid rain. That is a product of sulfur dioxide, again, which is emitted in large quantities by coal-fired power plants, mixing in the atmosphere with rain and snow. And when that comes in contact with a lot of the stone monuments, it's capable of eating away at the limestone. In fact, here in Washington, D.C., every summer you see work crews out doing repair work on the monuments. And much of what they're doing is repairing acid rain-related damage. And that, if they weren't doing that, a lot of the monuments that we treasure, like the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, would just crumble into ruin. And that's something that we really need to protect.
A lot of the inscribed words chiseled into the stone are just literally disappearing. They're melting away. And eventually they may truly disappear.
And, you know, some of the less obvious things, you know, our heritage is being impacted by toxic emissions like mercury. In fact, the Alaska National Park System is a good example of this, where the parks were created in part to protect the heritage of the native peoples who've lived there for thousands of years. And one of the things that's important for those native peoples is their subsistence hunting and fishing. And what we're increasingly finding in the northern Alaska Arctic is toxic metals are turning up, toxic substances that are not generated in Alaska, but that are coming from smokestacks in the continental United States. And it's extraordinary to think that the pollution that we're putting out in the lower 48 is making its way up to Alaska and actually could be threatening the way of life for many of the native peoples who live in the vast swath of national parks throughout that state.
And, of course, that also therefore relates to the effects of global warming that are felt there dramatically and as well really impacted some of the Gulf State parks.
Yes, you know, I think we saw with Hurricane Katrina year the warning signs of what could happen, of what's in store for us in the future. The Gulf Coast is the site of some of America's most important early history, from early Spanish settlements through the Civil War, and that really is a very vital place where our history is told. Some of the forts there that have withstood, you know, 400 years of hurricane seasons are starting to succumb to the damage because sea levels are rising and storms are becoming more powerful. And it's only a matter of time, given the predictions that they have made about sea levels, before those forts and those other historic structures are completely destroyed. And that's really sad because we'll lose a very, very important part of our history. And, you know, that may not be for, you know, 50 or 100 years, but we're actually feeling the effects now because just this year, the National Park Service has decided that they can no longer risk many of the important cultural treasures by leaving them in those parks. And so many of the artifacts that tell the story of those parks are being moved further inland. And I think that's a real loss when families go to visit a national park on the coast but can't really learn the full story of the history of that park and the history of our country, because many of the important documents and other interpretive materials that had to be moved out of the park to get them out of harm's way.
That is an amazing story because it's very telling. It says that people are taking precautions to protect these things because there's a good chance that in the future they're going to be impacted. That's interesting. I'll have to follow up on that. Also, one of the areas that everybody is affected by dramatically, but that is the horizon. You hope to see a grand vista, and it's a vista, but it's clouded and it's hazy. I can recall driving along the Blue Ridge Parkway, one of the most spectacular drives that if people haven't taken the Blue Ridge Parkway drive, it has to happen in a lifetime. But I was really quite surprised to the degree to which I really couldn't see much.
Yeah, that's interesting you talk about the Blue Ridge, because that is one of the areas that really have suffered tremendously in terms of loss of visibility. You know, you should be able to see upwards of 100 miles or more from the Blue Ridge Parkway, just to see the beautiful rolling hills of the Appalachian Mountains. But, you know, on the worst polluted days, your view might be cut to 20 miles, 5 miles, even 1 mile. And, you know, that really takes away the entire purpose of that parkway, which was created so people could enjoy the scenic vistas. Another example is Shenandoah National Park, which lies along that same line of mountains and really is a continuation of the Blue Ridge Parkway up north. You know, when that park was created, there are references in the congressional record to people being able to stand on Skyline Drive and see the Washington Monument some 70 miles in the distance. And that's extraordinary. I don't think anybody has stood on Skyline Drive and seen the Washington Monument in the last 20 years because the pollution is so bad. And that's really a shame. You know, this is one of the major attractions of these parks, is to be able to, you know, take a hike to the top of a mountain or drive to a lookout point and see the majesty of our natural landscape. And when you get up there and you can't see that, when all you can see is kind of a hazy view of maybe the next ridge and no further, I think that really takes away from the ability to understand how beautiful our natural landscape really is.
Well, it's so important to bring this up because we can otherwise just take it for granted and say, well, I guess this is the way it is. But quite honestly, to me, and the purpose of your report is to say, you know, we have an opportunity here. That's why it's called Turning Point. We can either just let things go as they are and perhaps even get worse, or, and this is the way I like to really interpret this, This is a challenge for us. This is something that we can do. There's no reason why we can't do it. And we can literally see the progress if we make wise decisions. Let's talk about some of the solutions that you're proposing to turn that corner and to clear the skies and make our natural treasury clear again.
Well, you know, I think I've mentioned several times during this conversation the coal-fired power plants, and that's really where we have to start. You know, there are hundreds of these older coal-fired plants that were grandfathered, meaning they did not ever have to meet the standards of the Clean Air Act. And these things are still operating, still belching. And, you know, Congress made a deal 30 years ago that these plants could keep operating and wouldn't have to install pollution controls. But if they ever had, you know, did any maintenance and had to kind of refurbish the plants to keep them going, at that point, that's when it made sense to put on new pollution controls, since they were making investments anyway.
They were supposed to upgrade at that point.
That's right. Plants upgraded. They kept operating, but they never put on the pollution controls. And there's been a lot of court battles in recent years to try to make them do so. But, you know, we're saying that's not really the way to go. That's not helping much. You know, law enforcement is important, and we urge it to continue. But Congress really needs to step in and say, listen, you know, this didn't work out. We made a deal with you power plant operators. The deal didn't hold. You haven't upheld your end of the bargain. Now it's time to clean up. You know, some of these plants are more than 50 years old. I mean, it's really past, long past their time that they do their part to help protect our national parks and our lungs, for that matter. And then when it comes to, you know, new coal plants is another challenge. We see that there are a lot of new coal plants out there under development. And, you know, we are not saying don't build them. We're saying build them in a way that protects our health and our parks. And there are technologies out there, some really extraordinary things that you can do these days that allow you to burn coal more cleanly. And the law, in fact, should require that those technologies be used. But unfortunately, many of the policymakers in the federal and state level are giving the coal operators a pass and letting them build plants based on cheaper, older designs that are far more polluting. Well, you know, then we turn to clean energy. There are many alternatives to coal. And, you know, with the recent energy bill that Congress passed last year, there were some very good incentives to help spur clean, renewable energies like wind and solar and, you know, biomass, which is kind of a fancy term for burning crop waste and things like that. And, you know, that's great. That's a start. But we need to do a lot more. And we need to level the playing field, because traditional fossil fuels like coal and oil and natural gas still receive the lion's share of taxpayer money. And, you know, I think that we really need to kind of level the playing field and make stronger and more lasting investments in renewable energy technologies that are clean, that help us meet our energy demands without sacrificing our national parks.
It comes at an important time, because many decisions are being made right now about our future. And it comes as an opportunity for us to really take a hard look at some of these issues and make the right decisions. We're talking with Mark Wensler, who's with the National Parks Conservation Association. Mark, why don't you give us your website address?
Yes, my pleasure. It's www.npca.org/turningpoint is where you can see our report. And also, we have a lot of other materials there. You can learn about air quality in the parks in your area. And you can see a lot of other interesting facts related to air pollution in the national parks.
There'll be a link on today's show page that will permit you to literally download the entire report, Turning Point, for free. I encourage all of our listeners to do exactly that and take a look. And Mark, talk a little bit about what the NPCA is about.
Well, the National Parks Conservation Association was established in 1990, not long after the actual National Park Service was established. And it was founded by actually the first director of the National Park Service upon his retirement from that position. And for the, you know, the past nearly, you know, 100 years, we have been out there fighting for the national parks, for everything about them, to try to make sure that they're well-funded, they have the resources they need, the rangers to tell people about the parks. You know, that's one of the most important experiences that people have when they go to a park, is meeting a ranger and hearing about the park. To make sure that they're able to maintain their roads and take care of the plants and animals that live there. We also work to protect the environments of the parks, the air, the water, and the resources. And, you know, that's really our goal is really to have the best park system in the world. And I think we certainly have that now, and we want to make sure that we never lose that, that we always have the best, cleanest, healthiest parks in the world for our citizens to enjoy.
The NPCA is the friend of the parks. They're out there fighting every day to try to really maintain our parks and maintain this heritage that is so vital to the sense of what it really means to be Americans, as well just to be connected with the wonder of the natural world. Mark Wenzler, I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News and wish you great success.
Thank you, Steve. My pleasure to be here.
I'm getting a little excited realizing that restoring the Earth to its garden state may just be the real challenge before us. Wouldn't that be exciting? Of course, there'll be those who will ask why. Well, we'll give you a few million good reasons why when your voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're all spending a lot of time at computers these days. Sometimes it's too much. But you have to admit, computers and the Internet have opened up whole new ways of learning almost anything about our world. And that goes for nature as well. And kids who invest their computer time wisely have access to some truly great new ways to learn about the wonders of our Earth. It's Webs to Whales and more. Stay tuned. There's so many parents that are trying to do the right thing with their kids these days, and themselves and their kids and their families and communities, and that can be a little challenge because sometimes in schools we're not fully aware of what they're learning. And for those of us who are concerned about nature and the environment, we feel a personal responsibility to care for our kids and help them learn our values and share our values. And so one of the ways that we do that as adults and as parents is to find great materials and products and things and make them available to our kids as an alternative to the endless games of violence and mayhem that otherwise kids are going to be drawn to. I found a great product here that I think people would be very interested to know about. To talk about this, we're talking with the publisher, Cheryl Block, with Block Publishing. Cheryl, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
First of all, let's talk about the two CDs specifically so people know what we're talking about.
Well, I actually have started a series called Webs to Whales Nature Tales. And so the focus is going to be on getting kids excited about different animal families. So far we've done two different titles. One is The Rainbow Web, which focuses on spiders. And then the second one is True Blue Friend, which focuses on whales. And they actually have a hardbound picture book that goes along with the CD. So we're trying to integrate science in through reading, math, and several different areas of learning.
Now, who specifically is this geared to?
Pretty much we're gearing it for children ages 4 to 8. It's something that can be used in the classroom, but it's also a great product for parents to use with their kids at home. We've made the software really easy so that children can sit down and play it themselves with very little supervision. They're available in different bookstores. They're also available on my website where they can order directly from me at www.blockpub.com. They're also available through a number of small retailers.
Let's talk about a parent or perhaps someone who's homeschooling their children or perhaps a grandparent that has an interest in making sure that their grandkids are sensitive to the natural world. I have a copy of True Blue Friend, which is about whales, and I found it really a rich experience in terms of learning about whales. But Give the listeners a sense of what they would experience when they listen to True Blue Friend.
Well, actually what we did was we focused on whale conservation in particular, because whales are endangered, particularly from things that humans do. And so in the story, we have a little humpback whale whose curiosity ends up getting him trapped in a fishing net. And luckily, through his friendship with a big blue whale, he's saved. But he learns a lesson. And then what we did was we went and taught kids all about whales. One particular thing is that whales, of course, are not fish. So on the CD, kids will be able to click on a diagram of a whale, pull up actual photos of different features of the whale, like the blowholes or the tail flukes, and then compare it to photos of a fish so that they can see the similarities and differences. On True Blue Friend, we also included videos of the whale behaviors so that kids can sit back there in their own homes and watch a whale as if they were out on a whale boat. They can see it breaching in the water. They can see the different kinds of flips and jumps that whales do. Humpbacks are considered sort of the acrobats of the whale family. And it's to give kids a chance to really interact and see what whales do, learn more information about them. We also try and include some physics as well. So on the True Blue Friend CD, we have a lesson about echolocation so that they can experiment with sound. The idea is to, for kids and grandparents in particular, to have a book that with a fictional story that the kids and parents can share together, and then let the kids loose to explore more about the science behind the story.
And, of course, there's a series of printed materials you get off the CD, or teachers can use them as well from the website or from the CD to enhance the experience so that the kids can then apply this in a creative way.
That's right. Science is great for integrating all different kinds of learning, critical thinking, math. So I try and take the information that the kids got and have them go further. I don't consider the computer to be the end result. It's a learning tool, so you learn some information, and then you go further and you apply it in some different ways. So they can do things like take a different whale and measure how long it is in little tiny fish and make a comparison, say, between an orca and a blue whale. Do a variety of different things, some art projects, some science projects. The idea is to keep the learning going, not just to stop with the CD.
You definitely are committed to critical thinking, because one of the areas, Fluke Match, it's called. And what this is really interesting, because it has different levels. There's kind of like a beginning and intermediate and an expert level. And it's kind of a game, but the game gets more complex. Why don't you express the approach to how it is that this becomes an ever more complex challenge? I think it's very interesting.
Okay. Well, the reason that we did Fluke Match, for one thing, is that the way people have fingerprints that are individually unique to each person, whales have patterns on their tail flukes that are individual to each particular whale. So we decided, playing the standard concentration game, to use whale flukes, but we begin with simple diagrams, and the child has to match the different diagrams. As we move up, we started using actual photographs of whale flukes, and by the time you reach the expert level, you are actually looking at a photo of the same whale fluke in two different perspectives. The idea being that kids are not only playing a matching memory game, but they're also learning something about how whales are actually identified and tracked when they're migrating out in the wild.
The skill is applied to all work in the field. Anyone who wishes to observe nature, you look at a field guide, for example, and of course that's one picture of a bird. Yet when you go out into the wild, you have to make some adaptation to that to be able to accurately identify. So it's a wonderful field technique for an early budding scientist.
One of the early stages for children in getting involved in science is to become good observers. So step one is to be able to observe, then you begin to do something with the information that you've gathered, and we try and take them to that next level as well.
I very much enjoyed True Blue Friend, which is the CD about the whale, CD and book, actually, it's a combination. Talk also about The Rainbow Web.
Well, The Rainbow Web was the first title that we came up with, and that one was a lot of fun because it's very imaginative. sort of pondered the idea one day of what it would be like if a little spider spun a web that was colored rather than transparent the way they are. We based it on the fact that the little spider in the story loved to watch the rainbows that were cast on his web as the sun kind of filtered through the dewdrops. And that led to his then building a rainbow web, and he realized why spiders spin transparent webs and not colored ones in the story. And so there was a premise then for learning more about spiders. And one of the things I like to do, the reason I do fictional stories rather than nonfiction, is so that kids can then to learn, make a comparison between what is fact and what is fantasy. Where do you find the evidence for what might be true? For instance, could a spider spin a colorful web, or would a spider eat berries versus insects? So it's a good way to get children engaged in thinking about the animal and then wanting to learn more about it. And so on the CD-ROM for the rainbow web, we have them comparing spiders to insects so they can learn the differences between the two. We have just a smattering of some of the variety of spiders that are out there. I myself was amazed. I didn't know a lot about spiders before I started doing the research, and there's some pretty amazing looking spiders out there. And they also learn that spiders are actually a good thing. You know, very few of them are dangerous, and they really are quite helpful in the environment in keeping the bug population down.
I do like the concept that you're actually weaving these fanciful tales, because kids actually do that anyway. They take the facts and make things up and play with ideas, and that's a really important part of learning.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And this melding of creativity and science is, I think, personally, where real life begins and finds meaning, is the balancing of those two. So I think it's an important element. How is it that you came into working on these CDs, but also focusing on nature?
Kind of a combination of things. I've always been an avid gardener, and I love the outdoors. The reason for doing science was twofold. My background is as a special education teacher, and usually when you're teaching special ed, you focus on reading and math, the basic skills that kids need. But one year I was lucky enough to be the primary science teacher in a special education school, and it was a chance for me to pull together a science curriculum, and I found that the kids just soaked it up. It was amazing. For kids who are normally reluctant learners, I had them reading, I had them writing journals, I had them doing all kinds of things in conjunction with the science we did, because so often they never got exposed to science. So we'd do all different kinds of experiments and then carry it on into other areas of learning. And it was an incredible tool for getting the kids excited about wanting to learn something. So that was one reason I realized the value of science in the curriculum and how important it is. And then my daughter teaches kindergarten, and I'm finding now that science, because of the stress we have on testing, especially in reading and math, that science basically is getting overlooked. It just isn't getting offered, and I thought there's got to be a way to get science back into the curriculum. So if you go at it through reading, if you go at it through math, and you pull the science in there, science fits in anywhere, so it's a good way to get it back in. Also gives parents an opportunity to get some science into their kids' learning. So all of that made sense. And then I've been a guide at the Monterey Bay Aquarium for about 10 years now. So I love being able to interact with visitors to our aquarium, teaching them about the different animals that live in our ocean environment. And that was another reason. I sort of pulled all of that together and went, science is the way I want to go, plus books. I love books.
As a guide at the aquarium, are you noticing any changes in terms of how people are coming to that experience?
That's an interesting question. I do find that we get kids a lot of times that come pretty well prepared. I'm actually impressed at the amount of knowledge that some kids have about the animals in the aquarium, which shows that they're obviously getting it either at home or through school, and that's a good thing. I'm more surprised sometimes at the number of people where this is their first exposure ever to something like this. That seems to be more the majority of them. And I think there need to be more opportunities for people to get to places like the aquarium. It's an ongoing to keep visitors coming back and returning and keeping them engaged and wanting to learn more. I find I never get bored being there, even though I've done this for a long, long time. I'd like to see other kids in particular have that same feeling, like there's always something new that you can see. There's always something new that you can learn. It just never stops.
And I find in my experiences as well, some kids are amazingly well-informed. They have find an interest or an interest area, and perhaps it's the access to the web and the Internet and other resources that provides them this opportunity to go in-depth and really explore their interests. Some people might criticize the Internet for various reasons, but I think it actually is a powerful self-learning tool when used right correctly.
Yes, I agree, and I think it's something that, you know, kids can get access now to tremendous amounts of information and timely information. And I think as long as there are a lot of really good, solid sites, and as long as parents pay attention to, you know, where their kids are going, it's an invaluable tool in learning and opening doors for kids, exposing them to things that they might not have learned about before.
We're talking with Cheryl Block, who's the publisher and author of a wonderful series, which probably is going to expand into the future, called Webs to Whales, Nature Tales. She has two books and CDs out that are available in bookstores and as well as online. I personally think that this would make a great gift to a child, but also, this is a thought that I just had. Sometimes a lot of parents may have an interest in trying to get these into their schools, but the red tape can be daunting. It may be better to really just go ahead and buy a copy and donate it to a classroom, your child's classroom, such that they can live on for a long time and be useful and really meet kids, make it available to kids who could use this. That's what I would recommend personally. Just go ahead and get it and give it to your school. They need all the help they can get right now.
That's a great idea. I actually like that. And the good news is we are correlated to quite a number of state standards, including the California state standards in science and reading.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be an excellent fit in the classroom.
Cheryl Block, publisher and author of the Webs to Whales Nature Tales series, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Sydney.
It's a big and miraculous world filled with complexity, wonder, and a whole lot of people who are trying to figure out how to live in balance with the planet. We just may figure it out. That's what we keep working on each week here on the Wild Side News. And we'll continue to bring you your Voice of the Earth each Thursday or anytime on the archives. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.